Then she returned to the front parlor with a rag for the piano. She had played 4 hours, mostly Bach, mostly half speed, but she was getting there. Now she had to wipe down the keyboard. It was important to remove the acid from the skin of her fingers. She knew the keys were actually some kind of sophisticated plastic and were probably impervious. But it was a devotional thing. If she treated the piano right, it would reward her. She wiped the keyboard vigorously, rumbling down at the bass end, tinkling all the way up to the top of the 88 keys. She closed the lid and turned out the light and returned the rag to the kitchen. Turned out the kitchen light and felt her way in the dark up to her bedroom. Used the bathroom, washed her hands, her teeth, her face, all in her usual strict order. She stood at an angle to the sink so she didn't have to look at the tub. She hadn't looked at the tub since Reacher had told her about the paint. Then she stepped through to her bedroom and slid under the covers. Pulled her knees up and hugged them. She was thinking about Reacher. She liked him. She really did. It had been good to see him. But then she rolled the other way and put him out of her mind, because she didn't expect ever to see him again. He waited 20 minutes before the door opened and Harper came back. She didn't knock, just used her key and walked right in. She was in shirt sleeves rolled up to the elbows. Her forearms were slim and tanned. Her hair was loose. She wasn't wearing a bra. Maybe it was still in the motel room in Trenton.
"You wanted me?" she asked.
"You still on the case?" he asked. She stepped into the room and glanced at herself in the mirror. Stood next to the dresser and turned to face him.
"Sure," she said. "Advantage of being a plain vanilla agent, you don't get the blame for other people's crazy ideas."
He was silent. She looked at him.
"What did you want?"
she said. "I wanted to ask you a question," he said. "What would have happened if we'd already known about the paint delivery, and we'd asked Allison Lamar about it instead of the UPS guy? What would she have said?"
"The same as he did, presumably. Poulton told us the guy is solid."
"No," Reacher said. "He's solid, but she would have lied to us."
"She would? Why?"
"Because they're all lying to us, Harper. We've spoken to 7 women, and they all lied to us. Vague stories about roommates and mistakes? All bullshit. If we'd gotten to Allison before, she'd have given us the same kind of a story."
"How do you know?"
"Because Rita Semeca was lying to us. That's for damn sure. I just figured that out. She didn't have any roommate, never. It just doesn't fit."
"Why not?"
"Everything's wrong about it. You saw her place. You saw how she lives. All buttoned up and prissy. Everything was so neat and clean and polished. Obsessive. Living like that? She couldn't stand anybody else in her house. She even threw us out pretty damn quick, and I was her friend. And she didn't need a roommate for money. You saw her car, some big new sedan. And that piano? You know how much a grand piano costs? More than the car, probably. And did you see the tools on her pegboard? The pegs were all held in with little plastic loops."
"You're basing this on loops in her pegboard?"
"On everything. It's all indicative."
"So, what are you saying?"
"I'm saying she was expecting the delivery just like Allison was. Just like they all were. The cartons came, they all said, 'Oh, good,' just like Allison did. They all made space, they all stored their cartons."
"It's not possible, why would they?"
"Because the guy has got some kind of a hold over them," Reacher said. "He's forcing them to participate. He forced Allison to give him their own list of names. He forced Lorraine Stanley to steal the paint. He forced her to hide it in Utah. He forced her to send it out at the right time. He forced each one of them to accept the delivery and then to store it until he was ready. He forced each one of them to destroy the delivery notes immediately. And he had each of them ready to lie about it afterward if anything unraveled before he got to them." Harper stared at him.
"But how? How the hell? How would he do all that?"
"I don't know," Reacher said.
"Blackmail?"
she said.
"Threats? Fear? Is he saying, 'Play along and the others die, but you live'? Like he's conning them all separately?"
"I just don't know. Nothing fits. They weren't an especially fearful bunch, were they? Certainly Allison didn't look it, and I know Rita Semeca isn't afraid of much. She was still staring at him.
But it's not just participation, is it? She said. It's more than that. He's forcing them to be happy about it, too. Allison said, oh, good, when her carton came.
Silence in the room.
Was she relieved or something? She said. Did he promise her, you get your carton by UPS instead of FedEx, or in the afternoon instead of the morning, or on some particular day of the week? It means you're definitely going to be okay?
I don't know, he said again. Silence.
So what do you want me to do?
Harper asked. He shrugged. Just keep on thinking, I guess. You're the only one who can do anything about it now. The others won't get anywhere. Not if they keep on heading the direction they've been going.
You've got to tell Blake.
He shook his head. Blake won't listen to me. I've exhausted my credibility with him. It's up to you now.
Maybe you've exhausted your credibility with me, too.
She sat down on the bed next to him, like she was suddenly unsteady on her feet. He was looking at her, something in his eyes.
What?
She said. Is the camera on? She shook her head.
They gave up on that. Why?
Because I want to kiss you again.
Why?
I liked it before.
Why should I want to kiss you again?
Because you liked it before, too. She blushed.
Just a kiss?
He nodded.
Well, okay, I guess, she said.
She turned to him, and he took her in his arms and kissed her. She moved her head like she had before, pressed harder, and put her tongue against his lips and his teeth, into his mouth. He moved his hand down to her waist. She laced her fingers into his hair, kissed harder. Her tongue was urgent. Then she put her hand on his chest and pushed herself away, breathed hard.
We should stop now, she said.
I guess, he said. She stood up unsteady, bent forward and back, and tossed her hair behind her shoulders.
I'm out of here, she said. I'll see you tomorrow.
She opened the door, stepped outside. He heard her wait in the corridor until the door swung shut again. Then he heard her walk away to the elevator. He lay back on the bed, didn't sleep, just thought about obedience and acquiescence, and means and motives and opportunities, and truth and lies. He spent 5 solid hours thinking about all of those things. She came back at 8 in the morning. She was showered and glowing and wearing a different suit and tie. She looked full of energy. He was tired and crumpled and sweaty and hot and cold all at the same time. But he was standing just inside the door with his coat buttoned, waiting for her, his heart hammering with urgency. Let's go, he said, right now. Blake was in his office, at his desk, same as he had been before. Maybe he'd been there all night. The UPS fax was still at his elbow. The television was still playing silently, same channel. Some Washington reporter was standing on Pennsylvania Avenue, the White House behind his shoulder. The weather looked good. Bright blue sky, clear, cold air. It would be an okay day for travel.
Today you work the files again, Blake said.
No, I need to go to Portland, Reacher said. Will you lend me the plane?
The plane, Blake repeated. What are you, crazy? Not in a million years.
Okay, Reacher said. He moved to the door, took a last look at the office and stepped into the corridor, stood still and quiet in the center of the narrow space. Harper crowded past him.
Why Portland? She asked.
He looked at her. Truth and lies.
What does that mean?
Come with me and find out. Chapter 27
What the hell's going on?
She asked. He shook his head. I can't say it out loud, he said. You'd think I was completely crazy. You'd just walk away from me.
What's crazy? Tell me.
No, I can't. Right now, it's just a house of cards. You'd blow it down. Anybody would blow it down. So you need to see it for yourself. Hell, I need to see it for myself, but I want you there for the arrest.
What arrest? Just tell me.
He shook his head again. Where's your car?
In the lot.
So let's go. Reveille had been 0600 the whole of Rita Sameka's service career, and she stuck to the habit in her new civilian life. She slept 6 hours out of 24, midnight until 6 in the morning, quarter of her life. Then she got up to face the other 3 quarters. An endless procession of empty days. Late fall, there was nothing to be done in the yard. The winter temperatures were too savage for any young vegetation to make it through. So planting was restricted to the spring, and pruning and cleanup was finished by the end of the summer. Late fall and winter, the doors stayed locked, and she stayed inside. Today, she was scheduled to work on Bach. She was trying to perfect the 3-part inventions. She loved them. She loved the way they moved forward, on and on, inescapably logical, until they ended up back where they started. Like Moritz Escher's drawings of staircases, which went up and up and up, all the way back to the bottom. Wonderful. But they were very difficult pieces to play. She played them very slowly. Her idea was to get the notes right, then the articulation, then the meaning, and then last of all, to get the speed right. Nothing worse than playing Bach fast and badly. She showered in the bathroom and dressed in the bedroom. She did it quickly because she kept the house cold. Fall in the Northwest was a chilly season, but today there was brightness in the sky. She looked out of her window and saw streaks of dawn spearing east to west like rods of polished steel. It would be cloudy, she guessed, but with a halo of sun visible. It would be like a lot of her days. Not good, not bad, but livable. Harper paused for a second in the underground corridor, and then led Reacher to the elevator and up into the daylight. Outside into the chill air and across the landscaping to her car. It was a tiny yellow 2-seater. He realized he had never seen it before. She unlocked it, and he ducked his head and folded himself into the passenger seat. She glanced hard at him once, and dumped her bag in his lap and climbed down into the driver's seat. Shoulder room was tight. It was a stick shift, and her elbow hit his when she put it in gear.
"So how do we get there?"
"We'll have to go commercial," he said. "Head for National, I guess. You got credit cards?" She was shaking her head.
"They're all maxed out," she said. "They'll get refused."
"All of them?" She nodded.
"I'm broke right now."
He said nothing.
"What about you?"
she asked. "I'm always broke," he said. The fifth of Bach's 3-part inventions was labeled BWV-791 by scholars, and was one of the hardest in the canon, but it was Rita Semeca's favorite piece in all the world. It depended entirely on tone, which came from the mind, down through the shoulders and the arms and the hands and the fingers. The tone had to be whimsical, but confident. The whole piece was a confection of nonsense, and the tone had to confess to that, but simultaneously, it had to sound utterly serious for the effect to develop properly. It had to sound polished, but insane. Secretly, she was sure Bach was crazy. Her piano helped. Its sound was big enough to be sonorous, but delicate enough to be nimble. She played the piece all the way through twice, half speed, and she was reasonably pleased with what she heard. She decided to play for 3 hours, then stop and have some lunch, and then get ahead with the housework. She wasn't sure about the afternoon. Maybe she would play some more.
"You take up your position early. Early enough to be seated before the 8 o'clock changeover. You watch it happen. It's the same deal as yesterday. The bureau guy is still awake, but no longer very attentive. The arrival of the cold Crown Vic. The flank-to-flank pleasantries. The Buick starts up. The Crown Vic turns in the road. The Buick rolls away down the hill. The Crown Vic crawls forward and settles into its space. The engine dies, and the guy's head turns. He sinks low in his seat, and his last shift as a cop begins. After today, they won't trust him to direct traffic around the Arctic Circle."
"So how do we get there?" Harper asked again. Reacher paused. "Like this," he said. He opened her pocketbook and took out her phone and flipped it open, closed his eyes and tried to recall sitting in Jody's kitchen dialing the number. Tried to remember the precious sequence of digits. He entered them slowly, hopefully. He pressed send. Heard ringtone for a long moment,
Then the call was answered. A deep voice, slightly out of breath.
"Colonel John Trent," it said. "Trent, this is Reacher. You still love me?"
"What?"
"I need a ride. Two people, Andrews to Portland, Oregon."
"Like when?"
"Like right now, immediately."
"You're kidding, right?"
"No, we're on our way. We're a half hour out."
Silence for a second.
"Andrews to Portland, Oregon, right?"
Trent said.
"Right."
"How fast do you need to get there?"
"Fast as you got."
Silence again.
"Okay,"
Trent said. Then the line went dead. Reacher folded the phone.
"So is he doing it?"
Harper asked.
Reacher nodded. "He owes me," he said, "so let's go."
She let in the clutch and drove out of the lot into the approach road. The tiny car rode hard over the speed bumps. She passed by the FBI guard and accelerated into the curve and blasted through the first Marine checkpoint. Reacher saw heads turning in the corner of his eye, startled faces under green helmets.
"So what is it?"
she asked again. "Truth and lies," he said, "and means, motive, opportunity. The holy trinity of law enforcement. 3 out of 3 is the real deal, right?"
"I can't even get 1 out of 3, she said. "What's the key?"
They cleared the second Marine checkpoint, traveling fast. More swiveling, helmeted heads watched them go.
"Bits and pieces," he said.
"We know everything we need to know. Some of it we've known for days, but we screwed up everywhere, Harper. Big mistakes and wrong assumptions." She made the blind left north onto 95. Traffic was heavy. They were in the far outer echoes of D.C.'s morning rush hour. She changed lanes and was balked by the cars ahead and braked hard.
"Shit," he said. "Don't worry," she said. "Semeca's guarded out there. They all are."
"Not well enough. Not until we get there. This is a cool, cool customer."
She nodded and dodged left and right, looking for the fastest lane. They were all slow. Her speed dropped from 40 to 30. Then all the way down to 20.
You use your field glasses, and you watch his first bathroom break. He's been in the car an hour, swilling the coffee he brought with him. Now he needs to unload it. The driver's door opens, and he pivots in his seat and puts his big feet down on the ground and hauls himself out. He's stiff from sitting. He stretches, steadying himself with a hand on the roof of the car. He closes the door and walks around the hood into the driveway, up the path. You see him step up onto the porch. You see his hand move to the bell push. You see him step back and wait. You don't see her at the door. The angle is wrong. But he nods and smiles at something and steps inside. You keep the field glasses focused, and 3 or 4 minutes later he's back on the porch, moving away, looking over his shoulder, talking. Then he turns ahead and walks back down the path, down the driveway, round the hood of his car. He gets back in. The suspension eases downward on his side and his door closes. He sinks down in his seat. His head turns. He watches. She flicked the tiny car right and put it on the shoulder, eased the speed up to 30, 35, and hauled past the stalled traffic on the inside. The shoulder was rough and littered with gravel and debris. On their left, the tires on the stationary 18-wheelers were taller than the car. "What mistakes?" she said. "What wrong assumptions?"
"Very, very ironic ones in the circumstances," he said. "But it's not entirely our fault. I think we swallowed a few big lies, too."
"What lies?"
"Big, beautiful, breathtaking lies," he said. "So big and so obvious, nobody even saw them for what they were."
She breathed hard and tried to relax again after the cop went back out. He was in and out all day long. It ruined her concentration. To play this thing properly, you needed to be in some kind of trance, and the damn silly cop kept on interrupting it. She sat down and played it through again, 12 times, 15, 20, all the way from the first measure to the last. She was note perfect, but that was nothing. Was the meaning there? Was there emotion in the sound, thought? On the whole, she reckoned there was. She played it again once, then twice. she smiled to herself. Saw her face reflected back from the glossy black of the keyboard lid and smiled again. She was making progress. Now all she had to do was bring the speed up, but not too much. She preferred Bach played slowly. Too much speed trivialized it. Although it was fundamentally trivial music. But that was all part of Bach's mind game, she thought. He deliberately wrote trivial music that just begged to be played with great ceremony. She stood up and stretched, closed the keyboard lid, and walked out to the hallway. Lunch was the next problem. She had to force herself to eat. Maybe everybody who lived alone had the same problem. Solo mealtimes weren't much fun. There were footprints on the hallway parquet. Big, muddy feet. The damn cop ruining everything. Spoiling her musical concentration. Spoiling the shine of her floors. She stared at the mess, and while she was staring, the doorbell rang. The idiot was here again. What the hell was the matter with him? Where was his bladder control? She stepped around the footprints and opened the door. No, she said.
What?
No, you can't use the bathroom. I'm sick of it.
Lady, I need to, he said. That was the arrangement.
Well, the arrangement has changed, she said. I don't want you coming in here anymore. It's ridiculous. You're driving me crazy.
I have to be here.
It's ridiculous, she said again. I don't need your protection. Just go away, will you? She closed the door firmly, locked it tight, and walked away to the kitchen, breathing hard. He doesn't go in. You watch very carefully. He just stands there on the porch, at first surprised, then a little disgruntled. You can see it right there in his body language. He says three things, leaning fractionally backward in self-defense, and then the door must be closing in his face because he steps back suddenly. He looks wounded. He stands still and stares and then turns around and walks back down the path 20 seconds after walking up it. So what's that about? He walks around the hood of his car and opens the door. Doesn't get all the way in. He sits sideways with his feet still out on the road. He leans over and picks up his radio mic. Holds it in his hand for 30 seconds, looking at it, thinking. Then he puts it back. Obviously, he's not going to call it in. He's not going to tell his sergeant, "Sir, she won't let me pee anymore." So what's he going to do? Is this going to change anything? They got to Andrews by driving most of the way on the shoulder and pushing in and out of the inside lane when necessary. The base itself was an oasis of calm. Nothing much was happening. There was a helicopter in the air, but it was far enough away to be noiseless. Trent had left Reacher's name at the gate. That was clear because the guard was expecting them. He raised the barrier and told them to park at the Marine Transport Office and inquire within. Harper put the yellow car in line with four dull olive Chevrolets and killed the motor. Joined Reacher on the blacktop and followed him to the office door. A corporal stared at her and passed them to a sergeant who stared at her and passed them to a captain. The captain stared at her and told them a new Transport Boeing's flight test was being rerouted to Portland instead of San Diego. He said they could hitch a ride on it. He said they would be the only passengers. Then he said takeoff was scheduled in 3 hours.
3 hours? Reacher repeated. Portland's a civilian airport, the captain said. It's a flight plan problem.
Reacher was silent. The guy just shrugged.
Best the colonel could do, he said.
Chapter 28. The captain showed them to a pre-flight waiting room on the second floor. It was a utilitarian space lit by fluorescent tubes, linoleum on the floor, plastic stacking chairs in untidy formation around low tables, old coffee rings on the tables, a trash can in the corner full of discarded cups.
It's not much, the captain said, but then it's all we got. All kinds of top brass wait in here.
Reacher thought, do they wait 3 hours? But he said nothing. Just thanked the guy and stood at the window and stared out at the runways. Nothing much was happening down there. Harper joined him for a second, and then turned back and sat down in a chair.
"Talk to me," she said. "What is it?"
"Start with the motive," he said. "Who's got a motive?"
"I don't know."
"Go back to Amy Callan. Suppose she'd been the only victim. Who would you be looking at for a motive?"
"Her husband."
"Why her husband?"
"Dead wife, you always look at the husband," she said.
"Because motives are often personal, and the closest connection to a wife is a husband." "And how would you be looking at him?"
"How? Same as always. We'd sweat him, sweat his alibi, keep on going until something busted open.
And he wouldn't hold up, right? Sooner or later he'd crack." Reacher nodded. "Okay. So suppose it is Amy Callan's husband. How does he avoid getting sweated like that?"
"He can't avoid it."
"Yes, he can. He can avoid it by going out and finding a bunch of women with some kind of a similarity with his wife and killing them too. Doing it in some bizarre fashion that he knows is going to get everybody rushing off on some flight of fancy. In other words, he can camouflage his chosen target behind a farrago of bullshit. He can take the spotlight off of himself by burying the personal connection in a crowd. Like, where's the best place to hide a grain of sand?" She nodded.
"On the beach."
"Right," he said.
"So is it Callan's husband?"
"No, it isn't," he said. "But..."
"But we only need a motive against one of the women," she said. "Not all of them together. All but one are just decoys. Sand on the beach."
"Camouflage," he said. "Background noise."
"So which one? Which one is the real target?"
Reacher said nothing, moved away from the window, and sat down to wait.
You wait. It's cold up there in the hills, cold and uncomfortable, crouched next to the rocks. The wind is blowing in from the west, and it's damp. But you just wait.
Surveillance is important.
Certainty is everything. You know that if you stay focused, you can do anything. Anything at all. So you wait. You watch the cop in his car and amuse yourself thinking about his plight. He's a few hundred feet away, but he's in a different world. You can step away from your rock and you've got 1,000,000 acres of mountainside to use as a bathroom. He's down there in civilization. Streets, sidewalks, people's yards. He can't use them. He'd be arrested. He'd have to arrest himself. And he's not running the motor, so the car must be cold. Does that make it better or worse? You watch him, and you wait.
The captain came back a little before the 3 hours were up. He led them downstairs and out through the same door they had used on the way in. A staff car was waiting there. "Have a pleasant flight," he said. The car drove them a mile around the perimeter track, and then cut across toward a Boeing airliner standing alone on the apron. Fuel bowsers were disconnecting and ground crew were swarming. The plane was brand new and stark white.
"We don't paint them until we know they work right," the driver said.
There was a wheeled ladder at the forward cabin door. Flight crew in uniform clustered at the top with fat briefcases and clipboards thick with paper. "Welcome aboard," the co-pilot said. "You should be able to find an empty seat." There were 260 of them. It was a regular passenger plane with the fripperies stripped out. No television, no in-flight magazines, no stewardess call buttons, no blankets, no pillows, no headsets. The seats were all the same color, khaki. The fabric was crisp and it smelled new. Reacher took 3 seats for himself and sat sideways, propped up against the window.
"We've done a lot of flying in the last few days," he said.
Harper sat down beside him, buckled her belt.
"That's for sure," she said.
"Listen up, guys," the co-pilot called to them down the aisle. "This is a military flight, not FAA, so you get the military pre-flight announcement, okay? Which is, don't worry, because we ain't gonna crash. And if we do, you're mashed into ground beef and burned to a cinder anyway, so what's to worry about?"
Reacher smiled. Harper ignored the guy.
"So which one is the real target?"
she asked again. You can figure it out, Reacher said. The plane moved back and turned, headed out for the runway. A minute later, it was in the air, smooth, quiet, and powerful. Then it was over the sprawl of D.C., climbing hard. Then it was high in the clouds, settling to a westward cruise. The guy's still holding it in. He hasn't moved out of his car, and his car has stayed right there in front of her house. He watched his partner bring his lunch bag. There was a 20-ounce cup of coffee with it. Poor bastard is going to be real miserable real soon. But it doesn't affect your plan. How could it? It's 2 o'clock, and time for the call. You open the stolen mobile, dial her number. Press on the little green telephone pictogram. You hear the connection go through. You hear ringtone. You crouch low in the lee of your rock, ready to speak. It's warmer down there. You're out of the wind. The ringtone continues. Is she going to answer? Maybe she won't. The type of contrary bitch who won't let her bodyguard use her bathroom might not be above ignoring her phone. You feel a momentary thrill of panic. What are you going to do? What if she doesn't pick up? She picks up. Hello, she says. She's wary, annoyed, defensive. She thinks it's the police sergeant about to complain, or the bureau coordinator about to persuade her back into line. Hello, Rita, you say. She hears your voice. You feel her relax. Yes, she says. You tell her what you want her to do. Not the first one, Harper said. The first one would be random, leading us away from the scent, probably not the second either. The second establishes the pattern.
I agree, Reacher said. Callan and Cook were background noise. They started the smoke screen.
Harper nodded, went quiet. She had moved out from behind him. Now she was sprawled across the opposite row in the empty plane. It was a weird feeling. Familiar, but strange. Nothing around them but neat uniform rows of vacant seats.
But he wouldn't leave it too late, Harper said. He's got a target. He'd want to hit it before anything unraveled, right?
I agree, Reacher said again.
So it's the third or the fourth?
Reacher nodded, said nothing.
But which one? Harper asked. What's the key?
Everything, Reacher said. Same as it always was. The clues, the geography, the paint, the lack of violence.
Lunch was a cold, wrinkled apple and a square of Swiss cheese, which was about all her refrigerator had to offer. She served it to herself on a plate to preserve some semblance of order. Then she washed the plate and put it back in the cupboard and walked through the hallway and unlocked the front door. Stood in the cold for a second, and walked down her path to the driveway. The police car was still parked right across the opening. The cop saw her coming and buzzed his passenger window down.
I came to apologize, she said.
She kept it as sweet as she could.
I shouldn't have said what I said. It's just getting to me a little is all. Of course you should come in anytime you need to.
The guy was staring at her, half puzzled, like he was thinking, women, to himself. She kept her smile going and lifted her eyebrows and tilted her head like she was reinforcing her invitation.
Well, I'll come in right now, the guy said. If you're sure it's okay.
She nodded and waited for him to get out. She noticed he left the passenger window down. The car would be cold when he got back. She led him back up the path. He was hurrying behind her. Poor guy must be desperate, she thought.
You know where it is, she said.
She waited in the hallway. He came back out of the powder room with a relieved expression on his face. She held the front door for him.
Anytime, she said, just ring the bell.
Okay, ma'am, he said, if you're sure.
I'm sure, she said. I appreciate what you're doing for me.
What we're here for? the guy said, proud and shy. She watched him all the way back to the car, locked the door again and stepped into the parlor. Stood and looked at the piano and decided to give it another 45 minutes, maybe an hour. That's better. And the timing might be about right. You can't be sure. You're an expert in a lot of things, but you're not a urologist. You watch him on the way back to the car, and you figure he's too young to be into prostate trouble. So all that's going to count is the fullness of his bladder balanced against his natural reluctance to bother her again. 2:30 now. He's bound to want to go at least twice more before 8. Probably once before, and once after, she's dead. The cloud cleared over North Dakota. The ground was visible 7 miles below them. The co-pilot wandered back into the cabin and pointed down to where he was born, a little town south of Bismarck. The Missouri River ran through it, a tiny silver thread. Then the guy wandered back again and left Reacher puzzling over navigation. He knew nothing about it. Virginia to Oregon, he'd have flown across Kentucky, Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska, Wyoming, Idaho. He wouldn't have gone up to North Dakota, but something called Great Circle routes made it shorter to go way out of your way. He knew that, but he didn't understand it. How could it be quicker to go way out of your way? Lorraine Stanley stole the paint, Harper said. The lack of violence proves the guy is faking it, but what does the geography prove?
We talked about that, Reacher said.
It demonstrates scope.
He nodded. And speed. She nodded in turn. And mobility, he added. Don't forget mobility. In the end, she played for an hour and a half. The cops stayed away and she relaxed, and her touch improved, better than it had ever been. Her mind locked onto the notes and she brought the speed higher and higher, right to the point where the forward motion got a little ragged. Then she backed it off and settled at a point just a little slower than the tempo was marked. But what the hell? It sounded magnificent. Maybe even better than it would played at exactly the right speed. It was involving, logical, stately. She was pleased with it. She pushed back on the stool and knitted her fingers and flexed them above her head. Then she closed the keyboard lid and stood up, stepped out to the hallway and skipped up the stairs to her bathroom. Stood at the mirror and brushed her hair. Then she went back down to the coat closet and took out her jacket. It was short enough to be comfortable in the car and warm enough for the weather. She changed her shoes for her heavier pair. Unlocked the door to the basement stairs and went down. Unlocked the door to the garage and used the keychain remote to open her car. The light came on inside. She switched the power on for the opener and slid into the car and started the engine while the garage door rumbled upward. She backed onto the driveway and hit the button to close the door again. Twisted in her seat and saw the police cruiser parked in her way. She left the motor running and got out and walked down toward it. The cop was watching her. He buzzed the window open.
I'm going to the store, she said.
The guy looked at her for a second, like this was outside the range of permissible scenarios.
How long are you going to be gone?
He asked. She shrugged.
Half hour, an hour, she said.
The store?
He said. She nodded.
I need some things.
He stared some more and arrived at a decision.
Okay, but I wait here, he said. We're watching the house, not you personally. Domicile-based crimes, that's what we do.
She nodded again. That's fine. Nobody's going to grab me at the store. The cop nodded back, said nothing. He started his engine and backed up the slope far enough that she could maneuver out past him. He watched her roll away down the hill, and then he eased back into position.
You see the garage door open. You see the car come out. You see the door close again. You see her stop on her driveway, and you see her get out. You watch the conversation through the Crom Vic's window. You see the cop back up. You see her reverse out onto the roadway. The cop moves back into position. She takes off down the hill. You smile to yourself,
and ease backward under the cover of the rocks. You stand up. You go to work.
She made the left at the bottom of her hill, and then the right onto the through road toward the city of Portland. It was cold. Another week of falling temperatures and it would be snowing. Then her choice of automobile would start to look a little silly. Everybody else had big four-wheel drives, either Jeeps or pickup trucks. She had gone for a swoopy, low-slung sedan about four times longer than it was high. Gold paint, chrome wheels, butter-soft tan leather inside. It looked like $1 million, but it was front-wheel drive only, no traction control. Ground clearance was enough for a decent-sized snowball and not much more. The rest of the winter she'd be walking or begging rides from her neighbors. But it was smooth and quiet, and it rode like a dream. She drove the 2 miles west and slowed for the left into the shopping center. Waited for an oncoming truck to labor past and swooped into the parking lot. Turned tight and drove around behind the right-hand arm of stores and parked up alone in the overspill lane. Pulled the key and dropped it in her bag. Got out and walked through the cold toward the supermarket. It was warmer inside. She took a cart and walked every aisle using time. There was no system in her shopping. She just looked at everything and took what she figured she was out of, which was not very much because the market didn't sell the things she was really interested in. No music books, no garden plants. She ended up with little enough in the cart to get her into the express line at the checkout. The girl put it all into one paper sack and she paid cash for it and walked out with the sack cradled in her arms, turned right on the narrow sidewalk, and window-shopped her way along the row. Her breath hung in the air. She stopped outside the hardware store. It was an old-fashioned place. It carried a little bit of everything. She had shopped there before for sacks of bone meal and ericaceous fertilizer to help her azaleas. She juggled the grocery sack into one arm and pulled the door. A bell rang. There was an old guy in a brown coat at the register. He nodded a greeting. She moved forward into the crowded aisles, walked past the tools and the nails and found the decorating section. There were rolls of cheap wallpaper and packets of paste, paintbrushes and paint rollers, and cans of paint. A display as tall as she was. Color charts were held in racks clipped to the shelves. She put her groceries on the floor and took a chart from a rack and opened it up. It was banded into colors like a huge rainbow, a big variety of shades. "Help you, miss?" a voice said. It was the old guy. He'd crept up behind her, helpful and anxious for a sale. "Does this stuff mix with water?" she asked. The old guy nodded.
"They call it latex," he said. "But that just means water-based. You can thin it with water, clean the roller with water."
"I want a dark green," she said. She pointed at the chart. "Maybe like this olive," she said.
"The avocado is attractive," the old guy said.
"Too light," she said.
"You gonna thin it with water?"
he asked. She nodded. "I guess."
"That'll make it lighter still."
"I think I'll take the olive," she said. "I want it to look kind of military."
"Okay," the old guy said. "How much?"
"One can," she said. "A gallon."
"Won't go far," he said. "Although if you thin it, that'll help."
He carried it back to the register for her and rang up the sale. She paid cash, and he put it in a bag with a free wooden stirring stick. The store's name was printed off-center on the stick.
"Thank you," she said.
She carried the grocery sack in one hand and the hardware bag in the other. Walked along the row of stores. It was cold. She looked up and checked the sky. It was blackening with clouds. They were scurrying in from the west. She looped around behind the last store, hurried to her car, dumped her bags on the back seat and climbed in and slammed her door and started the engine. The cop was cold, which kept his attention focused. Summertime, sitting and doing nothing could make him sleepy, but there was no chance of that with the temperature as low as it was now. so he saw the approaching figure when it was still about 100 yards away down the hill. The crest of the slope meant he saw the head first, then the shoulders, then the chest. The figure was walking purposefully toward him,
rising up over the foreshortened horizon, revealing more and more of itself, getting bigger. The head was gray, thick hair neatly trimmed and brushed. The shoulders were dressed in an army uniform. Eagles on the shoulder boards, eagles through the lapels. A colonel. A clerical collar, where the shirt and tie should be. A padre. A military chaplain, approaching fast up the sidewalk. His face bobbed up and down with every stride. The white band of the collar moved below it. The guy was walking quickly, practically marching. He stopped suddenly a yard from the cop's right headlight, just stood on the sidewalk with his neck craned, looking up at Semeca's house. The cop buzzed the passenger window down. He didn't know what to say. Some local citizen he'd call, "Sir, step this way," with enough tone in there to cancel out the sir. But this was a padre and a bird colonel, practically a gentleman. "Excuse me," he called. The colonel looked down and stepped the length of the fender. Bent down. He was tall. He put one hand on the Crown Vic's roof and the other on the door, ducked his head and looked straight in through the open window. "Officer," he said.
"Help you?"
the cop asked. "I'm here to visit with the lady of the house," the padre said.
"She's not home temporarily," the cop said, "and we've got a situation here."
"A situation?"
"She's under guard. Can't tell you why, but I'm going to have to ask you to step inside the car and show me some ID.
The colonel hesitated for a second, like he was confused. Then he straightened up and opened the passenger door, folded himself into the seat and put his hand inside his jacket, came out with a wallet, flipped it open, and pulled a worn military ID, passed it across to the cop. The cop read it over and checked the photograph against the face next to him, handed it back, and nodded.
"Okay, Colonel," he said. "You can wait in here with me, if you like. I guess it's cold out there."
"It sure is," the colonel said, although the cop noticed he was sweating lightly. Probably from the fast walk up the hill, he figured.
"I'm not getting any place," Harper said.
The plane was on descent. Reacher could feel it in his ears, and he could feel abrupt turns. The pilot was military, so he was using the rudder. Civilian pilots avoid using the rudder. Using the rudder makes the plane slew like a car skids. Passengers don't like the feeling. So civilian pilots turn by juicing the engines on one side and backing off on the others. Then the plane comes around smoothly. But military pilots don't care about their passengers' comfort. It's not like they bought tickets. "Remember Poulton's report from Spokane?" he said.
"What about it?"
"That's the key. Something big and obvious." She made the left off the main road and the right into her street. The cop was back in the way again. Somebody was in the front seat next to him. She stopped on the crown of the road, ready to turn in, hoping he'd take the hint and move. But he just opened his door and got out like he needed to talk to her. He walked across, stiff from sitting, and placed his hand on the roof of her car and bent down. She opened her window and he peered in and glanced at the shopping bags on the back seat.
"Get what you need?"
he asked. She nodded.
"No problems?"
She shook her head.
"There's a guy here to see you," he said. "A padre from the army."
"The guy in your car?" she said. Like she had to say something, although it was pretty obvious. She could see the collar.
"Colonel somebody," the cop said. "His ID is okay."
"Get rid of him," she said. The cop was startled.
"He's all the way from D.C., he said. "His ID says he's based there."
"I don't care where he's based. I don't want to see him." The cop said nothing, just glanced back over his shoulder. The colonel was getting out of the car, easing up to his full height on the sidewalk, walking over. Sameka left her motor running and opened her door, slid out and stood up and watched him coming, pulling her jacket tight around her in the cold. "Rita Sameka?" the padre asked when he was close enough. "What do you want?" "I'm here to see if you're okay." "Okay," she repeated. "With your recovery," he said, "after your problems."
"My problems?"
"After the assault."
"And if I'm not okay?"
"Then maybe I can help you." His voice was warm and low and rich, infinitely believable, a church voice.
"The army send you?" she asked. "Is this official?"
He shook his head. "I'm afraid not," he said. "I've argued it with them many times." She nodded. "If they offer counseling, they're admitting liability."
"That's their view," the colonel said, regrettably. "So this is a private mission. I'm acting against strict orders in secret. But it's a matter of conscience, isn't it?"
Sameka glanced away.
"Why me in particular?" she asked. "There were a lot of us."
"You're my fifth," he said. "I started with the ones who are obviously living alone. I thought that's where my help might be needed most. I've been all over the place. Some fruitful trips, some wasted trips. I try not to force myself on people, but I feel I have to try." She was silent for a moment, very cold.
"Well, you've wasted another trip, I'm afraid," she said. "I decline your offer. I don't want your help."
The colonel was not surprised, not unsurprised.
"Are you sure?"
She nodded.
"Totally sure," she said.
"Really? Please think about it. I came a long way." She didn't answer, just glanced at the cop impatiently. He shuffled his feet, calling the colonel's attention his way.
"Asked and answered," he said, like a lawyer.
There was silence in the street, just the beat of Sameka's motor idling, the drift of exhaust, a sharp chemical tang in the fall air.
"I'm going to have to ask you to leave now, sir," the cop said. "We've got a situation here."
The colonel was still for a long moment. Then he nodded. "The offer is always open," he said. "I could come back any time." He turned abruptly and walked back down the hill, moving fast. The slope swallowed him up, legs, back, head. Sameka watched him below the horizon and slid back into her car. The cop nodded to himself and tapped twice on the roof.
"Nice car," he said irrelevantly.
She said nothing.
"Right," the cop said.
He walked back to his cruiser, reversed it up the hill with his door hanging open. She turned into her driveway, pushed the button on the remote, and the garage door rumbled upward. She drove inside and pushed the button again, saw the cop moving back into position before the door came down and left her in darkness. She opened her door and the dome light clicked on. She pulled the little lever at her side and popped the trunk, got out of the car and took her bags from the back seat and carried them through to the basement, carried them up the stairs to the hallway and through to the kitchen, placed them side by side on the countertop and sat down on a stool to wait.
"It's a low-slung car, so although the trunk is long enough and wide enough, it's not very tall.
So you're lying on your side, cramped. Your legs are drawn up like a fetal position. Getting in was no problem. She left the car unlocked, just like you told her to. You watched her walk away to the store, and then you just stepped over and opened the driver's door and found the lever and popped the trunk. Closed the door again and walked around and lifted the lid. Nothing to it. Nobody was watching. You sort of rolled inside and pulled the lid closed on top of you. It was easy. There were reinforcing members on the underside, easy to grasp. It's a long wait in there. But then you feel her get back in and you hear the engine start. You feel a growing patch of heat under your thigh where the exhaust runs under the trunk floor. It's not a comfortable ride. You bounce around a little. You follow the turns in your mind and you know when she arrives back at her place. You hear the cop talking. There's a problem. Then you hear some idiot padre pleading. You tense up in there. You start to panic. What the hell is going on? What if she asks him in? But she gets rid of him. You hear the ice in her voice. You smile in the dark and open and close your hands in triumph. You hear it when she drives into the garage. The acoustics change. The engine goes louder. You hear the exhaust beating against the walls and the floor. Then she shuts it down and it goes very quiet. She remembers to pop the trunk. You knew she would because you told her not to forget. Then you hear her footsteps moving away and you hear the basement door open and close. You ease the trunk lid upward and you climb out. You stand and stretch in the dark. Rub your thigh where the heat has hurt it. Then you move around to the front of the car. You pull your gloves on tighter and you sit down on the fender and you wait.
Chapter 29. The plane landed at Portland International like any other Boeing, but it stopped rolling some way short of the terminal and waited on a distant apron. A pickup with a staircase bolted to the load bed came slowly out to meet it. The pickup was followed by a minivan. Both vehicles were shiny clean and painted in Boeing's corporate colors. The flight crew stayed on board to analyze computer data. The minivan took Reacher and Harper around to the arrivals lane where the taxis waited. Head of the line was a battered Caprice with a checkerboard stripe down the side. The driver wasn't local. He needed to check his map to find the road east toward the tiny village on the slopes of Mount Hood. She was in the house all of 5 minutes, and then the doorbell went. The cop was back. She came out of the kitchen and walked the length of the hallway and unlocked the door, opened it up. He was standing there on the porch, not saying anything, trying to communicate his request with the rueful expression on his face. "Hi," she said. Then she just looked at him, didn't smile or anything. "Hi," he said back. She waited. She was going to make him say it anyway. It was nothing to be embarrassed about. "Guess what?" he said.
"What?"
"Can I use the powder room?" Cold air was swirling in around her legs. She could feel it striking through her jeans.
"Of course," she said.
She closed the door behind him to keep some warmth in, waited next to it while he disappeared and then came back again. "Nice and warm in here," he said. She nodded, although it wasn't really true. She kept the house as cold as she could stand it, for the piano tone, so the wood didn't dry out. "Cold out there in the car," he said. She nodded again.
"Run the motor," she said. "Get the heater going."
He shook his head. "Not allowed. Can't idle the engine, some pollution thing."
"So take off for a spell," she said. "Drive around, get warm. I'll be okay here."
Clearly it wasn't the invitation he was looking for, but he thought about it. Then he shook his head again. "They'd take my badge," he said. "I've got to stay here." She said nothing. "Sorry to bother you with that padre," he said, making the point he'd intervened and gotten rid of him. She nodded.
"I'll bring you some hot coffee," she said. "5 minutes, okay?"
He looked pleased, a shy smile. "Then I'll need the powder room again," he said. "Goes right through me."
"Whenever," she said.
She closed the door on him and went back to the kitchen and set her coffee machine going. Waited on the stool next to the shopping bags until it was done. She found the biggest mug she owned and poured the coffee. Added cream from the refrigerator and sugar from the cupboard. He looked like a cream and sugar guy. Young. A little fat. She carried the mug outside and walked down the path. Steam swirled off the coffee and hung in a thin horizontal band all the way to the sidewalk. She tapped on his window and he turned and smiled and buzzed the glass down. He took the cup awkwardly, two-handed. "Thanks," he said. He touched it to his lips, like an extra gesture of politeness, and she walked away, into the driveway, up the path, in through the door.
She closed it behind her and locked it, and turned around to find the visitor she was expecting.